The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
We have a war on our hands. Gallup polls suggest that some 40% of the American population believe that the world life is only about 6,000 years old. That's not just wrong, that is catastrophically wrong. The people who believe that apparently are capable of leading fairly competent lives. They go about their business and they manage to walk through doors without bumping into walls. Despite believing something which is tantamount to believing that the width of North America is less than 8 yards. That's the scale of the error. My previous book, The God Delusion, was about religion. This one actually is not. This one, The Greatest Show on Earth, is a book that the Archbishop of Canterbury or the Pope should have no trouble with. And I don't want to see it as a negative debunking book. I'd rather see it as a positive book because the evidence for evolution is so enthralling, so exciting, enticing. It is the kind of thing that you just enjoy the spectacle of, this fascinating story of how life started very simply, perhaps a little bit less than 4 billion years ago, and has gradually, over the hundreds of millions of years, increased in complexity until eventually it produced us who are capable of appreciating and understanding the process. I'm going to take a few of the chapters in order. There's not time to do much. And I'm going to skip through some of the early ones. Chapter 2, Dogs, Cows and Cabbages, is about domestic breeding. Darwin himself used this powerful example in The Origin of Species. If you take something like a Rottweiler or a Pekingese and reflect that its ancestors were wolves not that long ago, and yet human breeders have managed to change it from a wolf into a Pekingese or a poodle or whatever it is in relatively short space of time, and then you think if that's what can be done in a few centuries or at most millennia, just think what could be achieved by selection in 100 million years. You can't actually imagine what 100 million years is like, but I can tell you it's an awful long time. The Primrose Path to Macroevolution kind of tries to seduce the reader away from artificial selection, domestic breeding, towards natural selection, going through intermediate stages like peahens breeding peacocks for their beauty, and insects breeding flowers for their beauty and their perfume. We human breeders, breeding flowers, breeding roses, whatever it is, have merely taken over where the insects left off. The insects started the process, and we carried on. But what we do to flowers is not that different from what insects do to flowers, selecting the most beautiful, the most colorful, the most highly perfumed. Silence and Slow Time is the chapter on how we know how old fossils are and how we know how old the Earth is. It's mostly about radioactive dating. Before Our Very Eyes is a chapter about those rare cases when evolution is sufficiently fast that you can actually see it going on before your very eyes in nature. Mostly you can't see it happening because it happened before we were born, and in any case it's terribly slow. But there are a few cases where it's very fast, and that's what this chapter is about. You can actually see it, and that should be persuasive to those people unimaginative enough to think that the only sort of evidence you should believe is evidence that you can see as eyewitness evidence of something happening. In the book I develop the analogy of a detective coming upon the scene of a crime after it's been committed, a murder, for example. The detective is too late to be an eyewitness to the murder, but nevertheless, the clues that lie scattered around the scene, fingerprints, footprints, bloodstains, and so on, are so persuasive that any court of law will convict somebody beyond reasonable doubt. Beyond reasonable doubt is an understatement for the evidence that is lying around the world today demonstrating that evolution is a fact. It is far more convincing than any evidence that has ever convicted any murderer ever. Chapter 6, Missing Link, What Do You Mean Missing? This is about fossils. Creationists love the fossil record because they fondly imagine that it's an embarrassment to evolutionists because they're able to point to gaps. That means places where there is not an actual continuous record, like a cinematic record, of exactly what happened. We're lucky to have any fossils at all. We're lucky that the entire history of life is not one big gap. Nevertheless, they think the mere presence of gaps must be an embarrassment to us. I want to read a short section from that chapter. We don't need fossils. The case for evolution is watertight without them, so it is paradoxical to use gaps in the fossil record as though they were evidence against evolution. We are, as I say, lucky to have fossils at all. What would be evidence against evolution, and very strong evidence at that, would be the discovery of even a single fossil in the wrong geological stratum. J.B.S. Haldane famously retorted, when asked to name an observation that would disprove the theory of evolution, "Fossil rabbits in the Precambrian." No such rabbits, no authentically anachronistic fossils of any kind, have ever been found. All the fossils that we have, and there are very, very many indeed, occur without a single authenticated exception in the right temporal sequence. Yes, there are gaps where there are no fossils at all, and that's only to be expected. But not a single solitary fossil has ever been found before it could have evolved. That's a very telling fact, and there's no reason why we should expect it on the creationist theory. A good theory, a scientific theory, is one that is vulnerable to disproof, yet is not disproved. Evolution could so easily be disproved if just a single fossil turned up in the wrong date order. Evolution has passed this test with flying colours. Skeptics of evolution who wish to prove their case should be diligently scrabbling around in the rocks, desperately trying to find anachronistic fossils. Maybe they'll find one. Want a bet? There's one especially big gap in the fossil record, which is before the Cambrian era. That's to say, before about 500 million years ago. I wrote about this in an earlier book, The Blind Watchmaker, when I said that the Cambrian shows us a substantial number of major animal phyla already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. You see how naive I was in 1986 when I wrote that. That was just begging to be, quote, mined. And I went on to say, needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. I wasn't that naive. I knew that they'd like it. Just recently, I decided to search the World Wide Web for that phrase, "It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history." I didn't add anything else, just that sentence. I obtained no fewer than 1,250 hits on that phrase. You need a control test, of course, if you're a good scientist. You might need to know, you want to compare it with something. So I compared that 1,250 with the number of hits for the sentence that immediately follows that in The Blind Watchmaker, which says, "Evolutionists of all stripes believe, however, that this really does represent a very large gap in the fossil record." In other words, there really were animals, but no fossils. So that sentence, the less favourable to the creationist cause sentence, I obtained a grand total of 63 hits, compared to 1,250 hits for the previous sentence. The ratio of 1,250 to 63 is 19.8, and I call this the quote mining index. You get a similar figure for the quote mining index if you look at a famous quotation from Darwin, where he said, it's something like, it seems to me, it might seem absurd in the extreme that something so complicated as an eye could evolve by slow gradual degrees. But, Darwin went on, I can show you that it could. And once again, you get a tremendous quote mining ratio between the first of those sentences and the second. There is one rather telling fact that I'd like to mention to you about the Cambrian explosion. There's a phylum of worms, very major group of worms, called the Platyhelminthes. That's the flatworms. It includes tapeworms, flukes, and the very beautiful Turbellaria, which are not parasites, and they're very lovely creatures living both in water and on land. They're very numerous. The number of species is even more than the mammals. But the point about this is that not a single one of them has ever fossilized. So we see plenty of modern platyhelminths, modern flatworms, but it is as if they'd been planted there yesterday. You can see the point. The next chapter, Missing Persons, Missing No Longer, continues the theme of fossils, but goes into human fossils. And I have a little passage here about Lucy, and then about the so-called Tong child. It seems quite likely that the species we call Australopithecus afarensis, Lucy's species, included our ancestors of 3 million years ago. Other fossils have been placed in different species of the same genus, and it's virtually certain that our ancestors were members of that genus. The first Australopithecine fossil to be discovered, and the type specimen of the genus, was the so-called Tong child, discovered in South Africa. At the age of 3.5, the Tong child was eaten by an eagle. The evidence is that damage marks to the eye sockets of the fossil are identical to marks made by modern eagles on modern monkeys as they rip out their eyes. Poor little Tong child, shrieking on the wind as you were borne aloft by the aquiline fury, you would have found no comfort in your destined fame 2.5 million years on, as the type specimen of Australopithecus africanus. Poor Tong mother, weeping in the Pliocene. The type specimen of a species or genus is the one in the museum that first earned the label of that name, and to which other specimens are compared when they're discovered to see if they belong to the same species. And it makes me think of an awkward fact about our convention as biologists. We always give animals, including fossils, a Latin name, a genus and a species, like Australopithecus africanus in the case of the Tong child, Australopithecus afarensis in the case of Lucy, Ardipithecus ramidus in the case of Ardi, who you may have read about in the papers recently, Homo sapiens, obviously our own species. Because we always name species in that way, and every single fossil that's dug up is named, and there are furious fights among paleontologists and archaeologists as to which species, which genus this fossil belongs to. Is it this one or that one? Is this skull a specimen of Homo habilis, or is it a specimen of Australopithecus africanus, for example? Now, of course, on the evolutionary view, there are bound to be some fossils that are exactly halfway between. They shouldn't have a name. If you need convincing of that, just imagine that every single animal that had ever lived, well, that's a little bit, too much to hope for, obviously. Suppose that all your ancestors in the female-female-female line had fossilized. So you have your mother, your grandmother, your great-grandmother in the maternal line, and so on. And you have these creatures, these people, arrayed in a line, and you walk up the line going backwards in time, backwards through the hundreds of thousands of years, backwards through the millions of years, back, say, to the common ancestor with chimpanzees, which lived about 7 million years ago. Now, by the time you get back 7 million years, the creature you're looking at is going to be very, very different. It's going to be pretty different by the time you get back to Lucy only 3 million years ago, or Ardi 4.4 million years ago. And yet, although they're very different by the time you've walked 4 million years, or 6 million years, or 3 million years, as you walk along the line, every creature that you see is the daughter of the next one. They are obviously of the same species. They are even more similar to each other than members of the same species usually are, because they are mother and daughter. And yet if you walk far enough, they'll turn into some completely different species. If you walk far enough, it'll turn into a fish. And yet in every single generation, mother, daughter, grandmother, etc., they are the same species. You never, ever find, you cannot find, an animal that is a different species from its mother. You see the implication of this for our naming convention. Despite that, we still give a name to every fossil that we find, and we even argue about whether it deserves this name or that name. Now, that's meat and drink to a creationist, because every time a new fossil is found, well, it's either a human or it's an ape, isn't it? Because we don't have the naming convention that allows us to say it's halfway between. Chapter 8 again mentions J.B.S. Haldane, whom I just quoted at the beginning. That irascible genius J.B.S. Haldane, who did so much else besides being one of the three leading architects of neo-Darwinism, was once challenged by a lady after a public lecture. It's a word-of-mouth anecdote, and John Maynard Smith is sadly not available to confirm the exact words, but this is approximately how the exchange went. Evolution skeptic. Professor Haldane, even given the billions of years that you say were available for evolution, I simply cannot believe it's possible to go from a single cell to a complicated human body with its trillions of cells organized into bones and muscles and nerves, a heart that pumps without ceasing for decades, miles and miles of blood vessels and kidney tubules, and a brain capable of thinking and talking and feeling. J.B.S. But, madam, you did it yourself, and it only took you 9 months. The next chapter is called The Ark of the Continents, and it's about the distribution of animals and plants on the islands and continents of the world. And the point here is that the places where you find animals are exactly where you'd expect to find them. Find species exactly where you'd expect to find them if they had evolved. It is almost too ridiculous to mention it, but I'm afraid I have to, because of the more than 40% of the American population who, as I lamented in Chapter 1, accept the Bible literally. Think what the geographical distribution of animals should look like if they'd all dispersed from Noah's Ark. Shouldn't there be some sort of law of decreasing species diversity as we move away from an epicenter, perhaps Mount Ararat? I don't need to tell you that that is not what we see. Why would all those marsupials, ranging from tiny pouched mice through koalas and bilbies to giant kangaroos and diprotodonts, why would all those marsupials, but no placentals at all, have migrated en masse from Mount Ararat to Australia? Which route did they take? And why did not a single member of their straggling caravan pause on the way and settle in India, perhaps, or China, or some haven along the Great Silk Road? Why did the entire order Edentata, all 20 species of armadillo, including the extinct giant armadillo, all 6 species of sloth, including extinct giant sloths, and all 4 species of anteater, troop off unerringly for South America? Leaving not a rack behind, leaving no hide nor hair nor armour plate of settlers somewhere along the way. Why did all the penguins undertake the long waddle south to the Antarctic? Not a single one to the equally hospitable Arctic. Once again, I am sorry to take a sledgehammer to so small and fragile a nut, but I have to do so because more than 40% of the American people believe literally in the story of Noah's Ark. We should be able to ignore them and get on with our science, but we can't afford to. because they control school boards. They homeschool their children to deprive them of access to proper science teachers. And they include many members of the United States Congress, some state governors, and even presidential and vice presidential candidates. They have the money, tax-free, and the power to build institutions, universities, even a museum, where children ride life-size mechanical models of dinosaurs with saddles, which they're solemnly told coexisted with humans. And we in Britain can't afford to look smug at that. A recent poll of the British population suggests that 28% of us think that humans coexisted with dinosaurs. We get our science from the Flintstones. The next chapter, The Tree of Cousinship. I think this chapter includes the most powerful evidence of all for evolution. Forget about fossils. Just look at modern animals and compare them in detail, meticulously. Darwin was able to do this with anatomy, for example, looking at the hand of a man, the wing of a bat, the flipper of a dolphin, the foot of a horse, the hoof of a horse. And you see the same pattern in all places. Five fingers. In a human, it's a grasping hand. In a bat, there's webbing stretched between the fingers to make the wing. A dolphin has exactly the same set of bones, but encased in a flipper. A horse, its ancestors, as you can see from fossils and you can see from embryology, had five fingers, five toes, but they lost all but the middle one. A horse walks. A horse walks on the nail. The hoof is the nail of the middle finger, of both the middle finger and the middle toe. But that's anatomy, and that's fine, and it's powerful, but it's nothing like as powerful as doing the same kind of comparison using molecules, molecular genetics. The genetic code is universal, which is a very, very important fact in itself. That's how we know that all living creatures that we've ever looked at come from one common ancestor. The genetic code's universal. That's the code that translates triplets of DNA into amino acids and hence chains of protein which function as enzymes, and that's the vitally important step in the development of all animals and plants. I say that the genetic code is universal, and it's also true that even genes are shared. You can say this is the same gene in a lion and a cow and a kangaroo. It's the same gene in the sense that you can see that it's doing the same thing, and it has pretty much the same sequence of letters, literally letters. These are textual pieces of information. You can compare them letter by letter, exactly like two versions of the same book, two editions of the same book. There's the odd misprint here and there to show that they're different. It's the same gene with minor differences. You count the number of differences, and then you compare the differences between various pairs of animals. Human and chimps have very few differences. Humans and rats have more differences. Humans and wallabies have more differences still, and so on. The pattern of differences between animals and plants falls on an exact, beautiful, hierarchical, branching tree. A tree of life, a pedigree. It's a family tree. You do the same thing with another gene, and you get the same tree. Same thing with another gene, and you get the same tree again. You do it for a pseudogene. That's a gene that doesn't do anything, although it presumably did in the past. That's telling evidence in itself. It presumably did so in the past. It's got the same kind of sequence as a modern gene that does something, but it's no longer actually read. It's no longer transcribed by the cellular machinery. It's read by human molecular geneticists, and they can tell that it's the same gene. And once again, the pattern of similarity between animals and plants looking at pseudogenes falls on the same tree. It's got to be a family tree. The only alternative is that the intelligent designer deliberately made it look like a family tree in order to deceive us. History written all over us is the next chapter, and this shows the legacy of history, the fact that animals have history written all over them. They have faults, they have design flaws, which no decent designer would possibly have ever written in, but which you can understand perfectly when you realize that they are inherited from some remote ancestor. I was privileged to take part in the dissection of a giraffe, which had unfortunately died in a British zoo earlier this year. And I saw a most dramatic demonstration of this. There's a nerve called the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which in all mammals starts in the head, in the brain. It's one of the cranial nerves. And it goes to the larynx, where the voice is. But it doesn't go straight to the larynx. It goes down into the chest, loops around a major artery in the chest, a different one on each side, and goes back up to the larynx. Well, in a human, that's a pretty dopey sort of detour. It's not a thing that any decent designer would have put in. But in a giraffe, it's a detour of 15 feet. And I watched this nerve as the expert anatomists were dissecting it, and I was rather lamely trying to help. And I watched this nerve going whizzing straight past the larynx within an inch of the larynx. Would have been so easy for any designer worth his salt. Way, way down into the chest, loops round the big artery there, and comes back up again. No designer would ever have done that. Chapter 12, Arms Races and Evolutionary Theodicy. An evolutionary arms race is a race run in evolutionary time between, for example, predators and prey, or parasites and hosts. Now, individual predators run races with individual prey. Individual cheetahs, you could say, run races with individual gazelles. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the arms race in evolutionary time, whereby the whole lineage, the whole species or genus of cheetahs improves its equipment, its long legs, its sharp teeth and so on, its equipment for chasing gazelles, while at the same time the whole lineage of gazelles improves its equipment for running away from cheetahs and other predators. It's a kind of economic arms race because, just actually as human ones are, economic resources that could have been used in the body for other purposes, such as reproduction, such as, say, producing milk, have to be diverted into the equipment needed for the arms race, for example, fast-running legs. So cheetahs and gazelles are getting faster and faster and faster as the generations go by, but it's a kind of futile exercise because they're both getting faster. If only they could come to some sort of trade union agreement whereby the gazelles agreed to sort of hive off a tenth of their number every year. Neither side would need to run fast at all. They could all just happily mooch around and get on with the business of reproduction. But, of course, that's not the way evolution works. I'm going to read a little bit about arms races. One thing about arms races that might worry enthusiasts for intelligent design is the heavy dose of futility that loads them down. If we are going to postulate a designer of the cheetah, he has evidently put every ounce of his designing expertise into the task of perfecting a superlative killer. One look at that magnificent running machine leaves us in no doubt. The cheetah, if we're going to talk design at all, is superbly designed for killing gazelles. But the very same designer has equally evidently strained every nerve to design a gazelle that is superbly equipped to escape those very same cheetahs. For heaven's sake, whose side is the designer on? When you look at the cheetah's taut muscles and flexing backbone, you must conclude that the designer wants the cheetah to win the race. But when you look at the sprinting, jinking, dodging gazelle, you reach exactly the opposite conclusion. Does the designer's left hand not know what his right hand is doing? Is he a sadist who enjoys the spectator sport and is forever upping the ante on both sides to increase the thrill of the chase? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Is it really part of the divine plan that the leopard shall lie down with the kid and the lion eat straw like the ox? In that case, what price the formidable carnassial teeth, the murderous claws of the lion and the leopard, whence the breathtaking speed and agile escapology of the antelope and the zebra? Needless to say, no such problems arise on the evolutionary interpretation of what's going on. each side is struggling to outwit the other, because on both sides, those individuals who succeed will automatically pass on the genes that contributed to their success. Ideas of futility and waste spring to our minds because we are human and capable of looking at the welfare of the whole ecosystem. Natural selection cares only for the survival and reproduction of individual genes. Come now to the last chapter, which is called "There is grandeur in this view of life." You'll recognize that as a phrase from Darwin, from The Origin of Species, the very last paragraph, which is one of the most eloquent parts of The Origin of Species. What I've done in my last chapter is to take Darwin's last paragraph, and I've taken each sentence of Darwin's last paragraph and made that into a section heading of my last chapter. And the body of the section is my exegesis of Darwin's sentence. I'm going to read just the last chapter of my book. The last sentence of Darwin's book is, "Endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved." And by the way, that's the only mention of the word evolved or evolution in the whole of Darwin's book. The fact of our own existence is almost too surprising to bear. So is the fact that we are surrounded by a rich ecosystem of animals that more or less closely resemble us, by plants that resemble us a little less and on which we ultimately depend for our nourishment, and by bacteria that resemble our remoter ancestors and to which we shall all return in decay when our time is past. Darwin was way ahead of his time in understanding the magnitude of the problem of our existence, as well as in tumbling to its solution. He was ahead of his time, too, in appreciating the mutual dependencies of animals and plants and all other creatures in relationships whose intricacy staggers the imagination. How is it that we find ourselves not merely existing, but surrounded by such complexity, such elegance, such endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful? The answer is this. It could not have been otherwise, given that we are capable of noticing our existence at all and of asking questions about it. It is no accident, as cosmologists point out to us, that we see stars in our sky. There may be universes without stars in them, universes whose physical laws and constants leave the primordial hydrogen evenly spread and not concentrated into stars. But nobody is observing those universes, because entities capable of observing anything cannot evolve without stars. Not only does life need at least one star to provide energy, stars are also the furnaces in which the majority of the chemical elements are forged, and you can't have life without a rich chemistry. We could go through the laws of physics one by one and say the same thing of all of them. It is no accident that we see... The same is true of biology. It is no accident that we see green almost wherever we look. It is no accident that we find ourselves perched on one tiny twig in the midst of a blossoming and flourishing tree of life. No accident that we are surrounded by millions of other species, eating, growing, rotting, swimming, walking, flying, burrowing, stalking, chasing, fleeing, outpacing, outwitting. Without green plants to outnumber us at least 10 to 1, there would be no energy to power us. Without the ever-escalating arms races between predators and prey, parasites and hosts, without Darwin's war of nature, without his famine and death, there would be no nervous systems capable of seeing anything at all, let alone of appreciating and understanding it. We are surrounded by endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, and it is no accident, but the direct consequence of evolution by non-random natural selection, the only game in town, the greatest show on earth. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd be very happy to take questions. I think there are microphones, and I've been asked to tell people to wait until they get a microphone before. So would you like to give the microphone to somebody? And okay. People had their hands up. Yes, okay.
The battleground between religion and science has been going on for millennia. Evolution is one battleground. Another is stem cell research. How would you advise us to wage this war? Because waiting a long time is hindering dramatically the treatment of so many diseases and disorders.
Yes, that of course is true. In the case of stem cell research, I think the advice I would give you is vote for Barack Obama.
Hi, you mentioned Haldane, and there's actually a pretty well-known Darwinist dilemma, and there's a very interesting Haldane quote on that, and there's some from Darwin and Crick and Pinker, and it basically boils down to that if you take design out of evolution and purpose out of evolution, everything pretty much boils down to physical processes, and so all your thoughts... you believe all your thoughts because of physics, not because you believe they're true. So Plantinga and a lot of other people have harped on this, is that it pretty much undermines the basis for your confidence in your own rationality. So if you believe in a form of evolution without design, you can't trust your own rationality and the conclusions you make, including that evolution is without design. And it's a pretty well-known dilemma, and I was wondering how you would answer it.
Yes, I am aware of it. I must say, I do think it's remarkably silly. It's if it were really true that the evolutionary worldview undermined our rationality, then things wouldn't work. I mean, we get into planes and they fly because they're based upon scientific rationality. They're based upon engineers doing a lot of mathematics, getting their sums right. Everything that we do that works, applying the scientific method, does so because we have rationality and because it works. If there were any doubt about rationality, planes wouldn't fly, cars wouldn't go, pipes wouldn't deliver water, etc. I think it's just a matter of... I suspect that line of argument is a kind of counsel of desperation for people trying to desperately to find some justification for their belief in their imaginary friend.
Thank you very much for an interesting lecture. Last year, audited a course in molecular biology, and I'm wondering in your book if you address this question. Even the simplest single-cell animal is extraordinarily complex on a molecular and chemical basis. Do you discuss in your book, or do you have thoughts to trace evolution back to this earliest beginning?
I think probably not explicitly, but you're quite right, of course, that the simplest cells we know, which are, I suppose, bacterial cells, are already very, very complicated. And in particular, the relationship between DNA and protein is a very complicated relationship, which depends upon advanced cellular machinery to translate the DNA code into protein. And so it's not something which you can easily see just springing into existence. It must have had an antecedent history, which we don't see. In particular, the origin of the relationship between DNA is a very complex relationship between DNA and protein, on which all life depends, or in some cases RNA and protein, on which all life depends, is a blank. It's a mystery. We don't know how life started. We know the kind of thing that it must have been, which was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule, almost certainly not DNA for the reason I've just given, which is that DNA and the sort of cellular technology that goes to make DNA work with protein is too complicated to have just sprung into existence. There must have been some kind of a forerunner, which must have been simpler. We don't know what that is. We don't know what that was. There have been various theories, some of them less plausible than others, none of them with any very strong evidence in its favor. The most favored theory at the moment is probably the RNA world theory. And it goes very roughly like this. DNA is brilliant at self-replicating, which is one major function in life. Protein is brilliant at catalysis, at being an enzyme, which is the other cornerstone of cellular chemistry and the whole of life. Neither of them is any good at the other. Protein is not a replicator at all. You cannot make protein molecules on a template of another protein molecule. DNA is brilliant at making copies of itself, but is hopeless at catalysis. That's the catch-22 of the origin of life. RNA is kind of intermediate. It's pretty good at self-replicating, not as good as DNA, but it's fairly good. And it is also a catalyst. It can function as an enzyme, like protein. So the theory is that the first molecule mediating life was RNA, or at least an early one was RNA. It did both jobs, both self-replication and catalysis. That got natural selection going, which is the great breakthrough. That's when things can start improving. That got natural selection going. And then after natural selection had got going, the replication function was taken over by DNA, which does it better than RNA, and the catalysis function was taken over by protein, which does it better than RNA. And RNA remained as a kind of mediator between the two, which is what it actually is.
What is your next book going to be about?
It is going to be a children's book, which I hope adults may also enjoy. It doesn't have a title yet, despite a publisher's announcement, which you may see in the publisher's press today. And it is going to be a book of questions about science, questions such as what is the rainbow, what is the sun, who was the first person, how old is the earth, what are the stars, things like that. Each of those questions will occupy a chapter. The first part of each chapter will be a collection of myths, mythical answers to the question. So in the case of what is the sun, for example, there'll be perhaps an ancient Egyptian myth about the sun, perhaps an Aztec myth about the sun, perhaps an ancient Greek myth about the sun. And then finally, what really is the sun, which is the scientific answer. Same for what is the rainbow. In the case of the rainbow, we presumably would stick in the Noah's Ark legend of the rainbow, except it might be rather fun in this case to put in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the origin of the Noah's Ark myth, so that children will recognize the myth, because they're all familiar with Noah's Ark and the animals went in two by two. But it'd be fun to see it under a different name than Noah's name. In general, my hope is to put the Judeo-Christian myth in somewhere in the mix of myths, so that children will get the idea that their own myth that they've been brought up with, there's nothing special about it, it's just one of many hundreds of myths from all around the world. So they'll get that message. They'll get the message that there are myths from all around the world. And finally, they'll get the scientific message of what the rainbow really is, what the sun really is, and so on. And the fact that scientific method of thinking actually does enable us to answer the question, what really is the stars or the sun or the rainbow? Might be nice to give the microphone to the next person while the previous one's answering it.
Does all cellular water have the same concentration? And if that is the case, does that suggest that the enclosure of these chemicals by a membrane all occurred at the same primordial ocean?
Right. No, it's not all. All cellular liquid is not of the same chemical composition. It's a bit more of the, I mean, the chemical composition resembles that in other cells rather more than you'd expect if it was just kind of random liquid from all over the world. But it's, and it's somewhat, it's sometimes said to resemble seawater. But no, it's not the same. So I don't think you could use that evidence to suggest that we all come from a common ancestor. But the DNA protein evidence is very conclusive indeed, because the number of possible genetic codes you could imagine to map from 64 triplets to 21, 20 amino acids and one punctuation mark, the odds of hitting upon such a code more than once are vanishingly small. Who's got the mic on this side?
Hey, I'm going to go back in time a little bit to your first book, The Selfish Gene. What first inspired you to start doing scientific writings, I mean, for the general public?
Well, I wrote The Selfish Gene in 1975. It was published in 1976. And what inspired me at that time was what I saw as an erroneous way of looking at evolution, the so-called group selection fallacy, whereby people thought, quite a lot of popular books had been written around the time, people thought that natural selection, instead of choosing among individuals and their genes, that natural selection chose among species or groups. Now, if that were true, it would be very easy to explain altruistic behavior in animals, cooperative behavior. Those species whose individuals sacrificed themselves for the good of the species would be more likely to survive in group selection than those species where all individuals were selfish. That doesn't accord with the way we understand natural selection works. So I wanted to explain to people how natural selection really does work, and I interpreted it as the natural selection of alternative genes in gene pools, and to explain how, from that assumption of the selfish gene, you can explain the altruistic individual. So my book could equally well have been called The Altruistic Individual, and I would have then explained how you get altruistic individuals from selfish genes. I called it The Selfish Gene, and also explained how you get altruistic individuals from it. This had the slightly unfortunate effect that some people who didn't bother to read the rather large footnote to the title, which was the book itself, thought that I was writing a book about how everything was selfish, or even that that everyone ought to be selfish. That was the very reverse of my intention. Who's got the mic?
I do. I really enjoyed your book, The God Delusion, and how you dealt with the extreme religious right. Have you considered writing a book to deal with the postmodernists and their attack on science from the extreme left?
The only thing I've written about that is a book review of a book by Alan Sokol and Jean Briquemont. My book review is in Nature, and I forget what it's called, but you can find it on my website, richarddawkins.net. Though I say it myself, I'm quite pleased with that book review. it's got some pretty juicy quotes from postmodernists, and it also has a nice quote from a website, which I think is based in Australia, called the Postmodernism Generator, which generates indefinite quantities of postmodernist prose at random. And it's almost impossible to tell, to distinguish from the real thing. It's just yards and yards and yards of obscurantist rubbish.
With my growing intolerance of religion, and with the help of your brilliant books, I've become increasingly combative and inclined to start this debate with people. But I find that I am very frequently defeated right from the start with people's, these yahoos, total misinterpretations of what scientific theory is. And they throw around the phrase, the theory of evolution. And I get frustrated, and the argument ends. Can you offer a clever and hopefully scathing response to that?
You mean the confusion over the meaning of the word theory? Yes. Well, I do have a discussion of this in Chapter 1 of The Greatest Show on Earth, and I include two definitions of the word theory from the Oxford Dictionary, one of which is the meaning hypothesis, where you might say it's only a theory. It's only a theory which is a tentative hypothesis for which we seek evidence. And the other is, and these are both perfectly good English usages of the word theory, the other is the usage as in the heliocentric theory of the solar system or the atomic theory, where the word theory is used for what pretty much amounts to an accepted fact. I mean, a body of theory which is widely supported by scientists and by evidence. And when scientists use the word theory of evolution, it's that latter type of word that they mean. But lay people often interpret it to mean the former, the only a theory, which has never been proved. What I've started advocating now is to actually stop talking about the theory of evolution altogether and talk about the fact of evolution. Because in the ordinary language sense of the word fact, it is a fact. It's a fact in the same sense as it's a fact that we are in Philadelphia and not in Chicago. Philosophers of science discourage us from using the word fact in science, and they'd rather we said it was a hypothesis that has never been falsified. Technically speaking, it's only a hypothesis that's never been falsified, that the world is round and not flat and orbits the sun rather than the sun going round. As Stephen Gould said, there comes a point where insisting upon this fastidious philosophy of science stance becomes perverse. And there comes a point where the ordinary language use of the word fact becomes appropriate. As it is in courts of law, when a lawyer may wag his finger at you and say, is it a fact that you were in Philadelphia on the night of the 23rd of October? And if you said, well, it's a hypothesis that it's hard to falsify, I think you might lose the sympathy of the jury.
Dr. Dawkins, thank you very much for your talk. I read that you have a foundation for science education. I wonder, in that respect, do you make an effort to preach to the so-called unbelievers, those who do not believe in evolution? And if you do, how often are you successful?
Well, it's true that I have a foundation, actually two foundations, one in Britain and one in America. They both have the same name, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, and they have the same trustees and the same aims. I suppose it would be the case. I mean, mostly we're there for promoting reason and science, but of course that would conflict with certain kinds of religious belief, creationism, for example. So, yes, we do, and I personally obviously do, as you can see from this book and from this talk. Do I ever have any success in converting people? Well, yes, actually. I mean, rather surprisingly, I get rather a lot of letters from people saying, thank you for opening my eyes, thank you for changing my life, thank you for awakening me to what I realize I should have felt all along, I should have thought all along, but didn't. They often then add, it's very difficult for me because my family won't speak to me anymore. Which we laugh, but it's not funny. I mean, it can be rather tragic, and I've had some very tragic letters from people whose parents won't speak to them anymore, or who've lost their fiancé because of it. I've had some much happier letters than that as well, including one from a young woman who said that she was greatly enjoying reading one of my books while on a round-the-world yachting trip with her boyfriend. And she said, and by the time we reached the Azores, I was pregnant. So I was given the credit for that.
Thanks so much for the work you do in the advocacy and the Out campaign as well. And thank you for opening my eyes personally. I wanted to ask you quickly about the campaign for miseducation that you only briefly touch on in your book, that's hosted in the U.S. by the Discovery Institute, the PR campaign team in Seattle, and that now in mid-November there, Ray Comfort is distributing 50,000 copies of Origin of the Species with a 50-page introduction that links Darwin to Hitler, and that, that's just one of the small things that they do. But I wanted to see if you thought maybe they're shooting themselves in the foot or what the next step is or what an appropriate response would be. And thank you.
These organizations are religious organizations which therefore qualify as tax-free charities. So the money that they use for their malign propaganda is tax-free. In the case of Ray Comfort, you probably know him as the Banana Man. You've seen his... you study a well-made banana. I see some of you watch YouTube. Anyway, his latest stunt is that he's, as the questioner says, he's got hold of the Origin of Species, which, with great perspicacity, he's noticed that since it's 150 years old, is out of copyright. And he has taken it and put a 50-page introduction, which contains a lot of nonsense, in the beginning of the book. The book itself looks like an authentic copy of The Origin of Species. It's got a copy of it's got a picture of Darwin on the front. There's nothing to indicate that there's anything dodgy about it. And you start reading the introduction. Even that starts like a pretty standard introduction, telling you when Darwin was born and things like that. And only gradually does it morph into what it's actually turning into. I was a bit worried about this at first, and then I thought, well, does it really matter? I mean, this, you know, he's getting 50,000, I think it's now 100,000 copies of this, and distributing them on campuses around America. I think the kind of person who qualifies to get into university at all is not going to be fooled by this, or actually... No? Okay. However, I did become a little bit more disturbed when I learned that Amazon.com are failing to distinguish between authentic copies of Darwin and this rogue version of Darwin. And they're muddling them. I mean, sure, it's inadvertent, but they've been muddled up so that in the star rating system of books, the Banana Man's version is getting the benefit of stars given to Darwin, and Darwin is getting the penalty of negative stars given to the Banana Man's version. People are writing into Amazon to try to get them to sort this out. I happened to meet a man from Amazon yesterday in New York. He was a senior executive of Amazon, and I pointed this out to him. He wasn't aware of it, and he said he'd do something about it. He then asked me to sign his Kindle edition of my... You can try to work out how I did that. But what I actually said in my signature, when I signed it for him, I said, thank you for sorting out the fake version of Darwin. So now he's got to do it.
Can you wave wherever you are? I can't see. Thank you, yes.
First off, we missed you at TAM. London, you didn't show up, so...
Sorry about that. Yeah. I inadvertently double-booked myself, and I humbly apologize.
The second thing is, you were talking about Ray Comfort actually a minute ago, and Kirk Cameron, and about the crocoduck, the half-crocodile, half-duck hybrid that they say should exist, and if it did, it would prove evolution. Wouldn't the appropriate response be that if crocoduck did exist, it would disprove evolution? That's how ignorant they are of the actual... the way evolution works, that they haven't even bothered to look up their own disproofs, or half human, half bacteria, or half any animal, and half any protist or anything like that.
Yes. If you'd come to my event last night, you'd have seen me wearing my crocoduck tie, but I've got my Galapagos tie on today. Produce your intermediates. Where's your crocoduck? Where's your fronky? If you think about it, if they seriously imagine that evolutionists believe there should be an intermediate between a crocodile and a duck, or a frog and a monkey, why not a dogipotamus? Why not a kangaroach? Why would you expect an intermediate between two randomly chosen modern animals like a crocodile and a duck, or a frog and a monkey. The number of pairs of animals that you could have chosen and sought an intermediate for is, well, I can't work it out in my head, but it must be, I mean, since there are about 10 million species alive, a number of pair combinations of 10 million species is, shall we say, not a small number. And of course we don't expect to see intermediates between modern animals. Modern animals are not descended from modern animals. Modern animals are descended from ancient animals. So you might expect to see intermediates, and we do see intermediates between old fossils and younger fossils, or between old fossils and modern animals. We see intermediate aged fossils, which are intermediate in form between older fossils and younger fossils or modern animals. That's the kind of intermediates you would expect to see. That's the kind of intermediates you do see. The crocoduck, as the questioner implies, betrays a total lamentable, crass misunderstanding of what evolution is about. But those people know their audience.
Hello. Thank you very much for coming to speak with us tonight. I'm wondering what advice you have for those of us who are scientists and or atheists and or just reasonable people who want to be proactive about what's going on in our society now, especially in this country. What can those of us who don't get to write books and go on book tours and go on Radio Times, what can we do?
I think it's rather a striking fact that the polls tell us that the number of, I won't say atheist, but non-religious people who have no religion, agnostic or secularist or atheist or whatever they like to call themselves, are actually much more numerous than anybody ordinarily realizes. More numerous than religious Jews, for example. Now, the Jews in this country are a shining example of what can be achieved by really effective lobbying. I don't know. I hope that's not a controversial thing to say. It seems to me fairly well known and more or less unopposed to say something like that. Why shouldn't the non-religious people become as effective a lobby, or actually more effective, as reflects our greater numerical strength? So write to your congressman, write to the newspapers, show your muscle, which is much more than most people realize, and I think is growing. In fact, I know it's growing. Two more questions. Okay. One on this side.
I don't know if you're familiar with Robert Wright. He wrote The Moral Animal, which is all about evolutionary psychology. I was wondering where you stand on the validity of evolutionary psychology and if any of it could be considered maybe as evidence or, you know, possibly true.
I'm a little bewildered by the extraordinarily vitriolic response that evolutionary psychology elicits, not specifically from Robert Wright, but from lots of other people. It does seem to be a red rag to a bull. I haven't really quite understood what it is. What they're doing, it's a kind of successor to sociobiology, which was promoted in the 1970s and 80s. And aroused a similar politically motivated opposition. Evolutionary psychology is applying to humans Darwinian thinking as it applies to brain mechanisms which manifest themselves in psychological characteristics or predispositions. Evolutionary psychologists often talk about modules in the brain. A module for sex, a module for aggression, a module for kinship, for assessing relatedness of kin, a module for reciprocation and all the things that go with it, like guilt and sense of obligation and sense of gratitude and so on. It seems to me entirely sensible that since we are evolved creatures who have been shaped in our evolutionary past by natural selection, that our brains and our psychological mechanisms and predispositions and feelings should be subject to the same evolutionary forces as our hearts and our kidneys and our kneecaps. It doesn't mean that you can interpret every single thing that a human does, especially in modern society, in evolutionary terms. Obviously, culture and history and sociology play enormously important parts. But we can't afford to just throw out wisdom that we might get by considering our ancestral past. So I'm cautiously enthusiastic about what my colleagues in evolutionary psychology are doing, and I find it mysterious that it arouses so much hostility. So one more question from this side.
Thank you for coming again. My question is, let's say hypothetically that we wake up tomorrow and everybody believes completely in evolution. What would change at that point?
Well, the people in this country would be enlightened by a wonderful vision of the truth about where they come from and where all living things come from, instead of what afflicts more than 40% of them, if Gallup is to be believed, which is a completely screwy and naive and inadequate and pathetic view of the reality in which they live. I can't prove that they'd be happier, but I think I'm a lifelong educator. It's a worthwhile aim to me to dispel ignorance and to propagate truth, especially when the truth is so enthralling and exciting and wonderful, which is what it is. Now, of course, there would be practical benefits as well. I mean, there would no longer be any opposition to things like stem cell research if people thought straight. But I'm well aware of those sorts of advantages, but I prefer not to bring them to the fore because I actually regard the almost aesthetic, almost poetic benefits of having a true vision of this amazing universe and world in which we live and the extraordinary situation we find ourselves in as beings capable of appreciating and understanding it. Thank you very much. Could I say I'm happy to sign books if people want me to sign books, but I prefer not to personalize. It takes so long. I'll just sign my name.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.